Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better, and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? Carol the Coach, sex, love, and relationships.
And I am Carol Jurgensen Sheets, aka Carol the Coach, and I am so happy to be with you this evening. Hey, this is Sex Help with Carol the Coach, and we are the show. We talk about sexual addiction, and we're the only show on the air, either internet or radio, that does kind of describe all the different dynamics. And whether you might have a sexual addiction or be in love with somebody who has a sexual addiction, we talk about it here. So I welcome you to listen to the show, to give us a call at 646-595-3284. And I can't emphasize enough that, you know, this is one of those topics that not everybody feels comfortable talking about. And so every Monday night at 9 o'clock, we talk with the experts in the field who talk a little bit about, you know, what is sexual addiction? What's love addiction? When should a partner get help? What kind of filters can you put on your phone, your laptop, your personal computer? We talk about what is a 12-step group. When do you contact a therapist? Who do you contact? Who has the qualifications to deal with this very difficult process, addiction? And if you've been listening to the show, you know I've been doing this for way over a couple of years, and I am ready to help you with your issues. So I cannot highlight enough how important it is for you to stay tuned. You can email me at carolthecoach@aol.com, and I'll be happy to answer your questions. And, of course, you can give me a call at 646-595-3284. Now, I'm really excited tonight because I'm going to be talking with a clinical addiction specialist. And she really has made it her mission to kind of differentiate between love addiction and sex addiction. You know, she says, the best part of my job is being part of a client's journey through recovery and witness them return to a life worth living. And that is what I've always said about any addiction. Now, if you've been listening to this show, you know that I have a lot of background in addiction. Parents were alcoholics, sister is an alcoholic, brother is an alcoholic, husband is an alcoholic, all of them recovering. And what I know to be true is that when somebody is working on their issues, when they are following a 12-step program, when they're in therapy with certified addictions therapists, they end up being healthier. You heard me, healthier than the average person out there. And so I think Roseanne Rook would absolutely, positively agree with me. Her mission, as we said, is helping people through recovery and witness them returning to a life worth living. Now, she conducts psychoeducational processes and support groups at Timberline Knolls. And Timberline Knolls is one of the Midwest hospitals that deals with addictions. Boy, Timberline Knolls is known for helping women and men rediscover and harness their strengths in five core aspects of the self. And that would be, and think about this, because when I do work with people individually or in group therapy, the most difficult aspect that they have trouble identifying is their emotions. Now, I know you would think that would be easy, but it isn't. And Timberline Knowles says, hey, there are five aspects to the human, and those are emotions, spirit, mind, body, and, of course, their social relationships. Roseanne has worked as an MISA counselor forever. She has worked conducting psychoeducational processes and support groups and individual counseling as needed. She's involved in treatment planning, discharge, and aftercare recommendations for addictions treatments at Timberline Knolls. She does presentations, and she wanted to talk tonight about what is the difference between love and sex addiction. She admits they're undertreated, and she wants to be a part of the solution and not the problem. So we're going to be talking about the definition of what love and sex addiction is. We're going to be talking about how can these two things be considered an addiction? That can be very difficult. What are the indications that a behavior has crossed the line from normal and healthy to addictive? What are some of the signs of a love or relationship addiction? And how do you treat it? Do you treat it separately? Do you treat it together? If you're a clinician listening to the show, what are some of the best questions that you should ask to help determine that? And, you know, what are some of the roadblocks to getting help for a sex or love addiction? Because these addictions are treatable. They absolutely require that a client follow a certain procedure. You know, I had a love addict in my office tonight, and he said, I do not want to block the numbers of the people that I care about. You know, if they call me, I'll set boundaries with them, but I definitely want to be available to any of the people that I care about. That is who I am. Now, from the outside looking in, that sounds very, it sounds generous. It sounds compassionate. It sounds like, wow, this person really does care about people. And actually, he does. But with a process addiction, you have to have boundaries that first and foremost, respect yourself. And that can be very difficult. Because so oftentimes, people that have love and sex addictions have been traumatized as children. Maybe they were abused. Maybe they were ignored, maltreated, neglected. And so what they do is they develop a relationship with others where they give to other people what they really want themselves. Well, I got to tell you, that is not going to help them grow and develop. Believe it or not, oftentimes when we're working with the process of love and sex addiction, we tell people, I want you to take care of yourself first and foremost. And that can be so very difficult because what are we told? We are told to take care of other people, that we need to put others before ourselves. And I'm telling you, oftentimes with a love or a sex addiction, which we call process addiction, it is imperative that the client really do take care of himself or herself first and foremost. So think about that, if you would, for a moment. I mean, if you're listening to the show, it may feel very foreign to say, you know what, I need to take care of myself. But that is the boundary that you need to have. And what does that look like? That may look like blocking somebody's number. You know, of course, it's after you've said, I'm sorry, but I can't talk with you because I have to work on myself. Boy, and that can be difficult because doesn't that feel like somebody is being selfish? Well, I'm here to tell you that when you work a 12-step program and you get in with a clinical addiction-oriented therapist, there is no doubt that you will learn what does it take to really, really identify what you need to do to get healthy. And I'm not kidding you, that can be incredibly difficult because you're not rescuing somebody. And that is so oftentimes what people tend to do. They want to rescue. They want to put somebody else's needs before their own. That just didn't work. So when I was working with this man earlier tonight, we convinced him that he needed to block all the numbers that he had so that he could truly work on himself. I mean, this guy was working very, very hard, and he really had made immense changes. But you know, when you leave a window open, a window of opportunity that in some way can create a relapse or a slip, you're setting yourself up for failure. Now think about yourself for a minute, okay? Let me just ask you, you're a sex addict, and you absolutely know that you should be going to meetings. And you absolutely know that you need to see a certified sexual addiction therapist. And you know that you need a sponsor, but guess what? You're going to the meetings, but you don't address the fact that you need a sponsor. So what ends up happening is it's like you're going through the motions of what you need to do, but you're really not maximizing what you could be doing because you don't have a strong guide to help you. You don't have somebody walking you through the steps and teaching you things that you can't possibly know yourself. You know, when people don't want to participate in 12-step meetings, or they do that but they don't get a sponsor, I know that most oftentimes they're putting their best foot forward, but they're not maximizing what they could get done. And so as a certified sexual addictions therapist, I'm there to help them create the strongest program that they can. Okay, now, as I indicated, we are going to be talking about love and sexual addiction with Roseanne Rook, and she works for Timberline Knowles, and she's been doing this for a long time, so we're lucky to have her on the air to give us some guidance as to how she works with people and what the definitions are of the problems that she sees. So, Roseanne, welcome to the show. How are you tonight?
Good. Hi, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, how long have you been in this field? And tell us a little bit about Timberline Knowles.
I've actually been in the addictions field for 20 years. I started with Timberline Knowles a little bit over 7 years ago when we first opened. And what we do here is we treat both adolescents and adults for substance abuse, eating disorders, and mood disorders, which have since then, a lot of the process addictions that have been surfacing are definitely being addressed at the same time. And we're in Lamont,
yeah,
Illinois.
And so if somebody wanted to get some help from Timberline Knowles, what would they need to do?
They call our admissions coordinators, actually, which they all have master's degrees in counseling, and they pretty much know the right questions to ask. And there's not much of anything you can't ask them to get the right direction. And even if we weren't the place to treat them, they could give them referrals, and who could?
Well, you know, I agree that oftentimes when somebody knows that they have a problem, when they've heard about a good treatment center, they at times think that they're the only ones that have this issue. So it is important to know that Timberline Knowles has a lot of expertise in all fields of addiction. And as you indicated, wow, they have master's level people answering the phone, knowing what it is they need to do to get them to the right places.
Absolutely.
Okay, now, we know that you have made it your mission to work with love and sex addiction as well as the other addictions. Tell me a little bit about sex as an addiction. Can you explain how being in love can be considered an addiction when most people think it's a normal and natural process?
Absolutely. And you know, love and sex can be a very love, you know, a normal process. It's when it kind of crosses the line on that. Kind of a short version of an addiction is to continue engage in a behavior despite the negative consequences. And by negative consequences, you know, I'm talking about in many areas of your life. It could be work, school, home, financial, social. So if anything that you're engaging in starts to affect those areas and you continue to do it over and over, it's becoming an addiction. And you can do that in love. You lose your identity. You continue to engage in the relationship despite, you know, you can have family members telling you that it's wrong for you. You know it's wrong. A lot of secrets come in, rationalization, justification. It's all the same kind of behavior that you have actually in substance abuse.
Yeah, so how might that kind of rationalization or justification get a person into trouble?
You know, I think sometimes it's a little bit more obvious when it's a sex addiction. You know, people can look at it or they're being found out, or especially the more prominent sex addictions like people see. You know, it doesn't mean they have to be going to prostitutes, watching pornography. There's a lot of subtle addictions, whether it's happening within their own home with their own partner, whether it's multiple affairs. You know, that's one way to look at it. But when it comes into the idea of actually being somebody in love, there's just a real confusion with that. You know, it's again, it goes down to having no self-worth, wanting somebody. It's kind of about, I guess I feel like it's getting the love, not experiencing the love.
Okay.
It's a quick
fix.
Yeah,
it is like a fix, and it also isn't necessarily healthy, even though it does meet that need of immediate gratification and attention. So,
right. There is, and, you know, that's just like a drug.
Absolutely. A fix for sure. Now, how does somebody know if they have a love addiction?
Well, some of the signs are actually, one of them is like needing to be in a relationship. I'm pretty amazed at the amount of women that say they've never, ever been alone. And actually, some of these adolescents are 16 or 17 and still saying, well, no, I always have to have a boyfriend. They really, so it's like no sense of identity. So they need to be in a relationship to feel okay.
Mm-hmm.
Often they can't break off a relationship even though it's become abusive. Often the way they feel is based on what their partner's feeling, saying, thinking. They start to agree with their partner despite not agreeing with a lot of what they're doing or saying. They panic when a partner shows disinterest. And a lot of times it isn't even real disinterest. They just may not have received a call or they just looked the other way. It starts to become, like I said, it's not always real, often perceived. Often they can't even picture life without having a partner. And
so
a lot
how do
of what
you work with that kind of person that, you know, really is that dependent on other people to help form their own identity?
I think the first thing is they have to see it as such. You know, there's a lot of, we go back, you know, with the rationalizing, justifying that, but I love them is always kind of the thing that people come back to. And this is where I listen to them and you kind of repeat back a lot of what they're saying about the relationship. And what I found a lot is they keep saying they love them, and I may ask them, well, what's your definition of love? Or what does a relationship need to be healthy? And they'll name these things, and it'll be, and do you have this in this relationship? And they usually say no. In fact, it's quite the opposite. And they'll keep going back, but I love them. And I think when they start to realize, you know what, I just keep going back to this, and I can't even tell you why. I have no problem always comparing it to drug or alcohol. And somehow they can see that better. Do you see you're doing the same thing? You know, every time you call that person, do you see just like it's a heroin addict picking up a needle? You know, their phone is your drug dealer. And somehow that seems to hit them. And
so
what I do
with understand it when they compare it to kind of that craving and withdrawal. With somebody. Yeah.
And that's just where I think we talk about it, where does it cross the line? And it absolutely does when it's becoming a problem. It also has the same signs as a drug addiction or alcohol or eating disorder. There is an increased tolerance, just as there is with the sex. It might start it's once a week, sometimes it's four times a week, or it may start that I'm just driving around the neighborhood the next time they're picking up prostitutes. The same thing, the tolerance will happen in relationships. It's like I'm okay if I only see them a couple times a week. Pretty soon it has to be daily. You mentioned withdraw. I literally have watched residents withdraw. There's somebody that was trying not to use the phone, and she would be pacing. Her hands would be sweating. There's a point when she got into our living that's outside of our environment. We have some housing. And she kept calling this person, and I asked her to give me her phone. And she literally was shaking trying to hand me the phone, back and forth, handing it over. And then she's like, well, for how long? And I don't understand why I can't have it. And it was just amazing what withdrawal she was going to go through by handing over this phone.
So what do you do with somebody like that who obviously is in a bit of denial, which is the first part of addiction, when you're in denial and you don't really see how destitute you feel or desperate you feel or, you know, how dependent you are on a relationship. So what do you do?
You know, first of all, you can't, it's the same thing, kind of like meet them where they're at. And it's really important because I think a lot of people are all over them saying this is a bad relationship, you got to get out. And there's pure terror in the thought of that. So for me, the first thing I go to is I'm not saying you have to end this. And there's an absolute, I think, relief in that moment because I'm not saying about now or today. You know, I also feel that if, and I've told them that if you're here and you're willing to look at this, you keep an open mind. You know, just look at some of these things. You work a program. If they're working a 12-step program and with any other addiction, as I tell them, if you work your program in every area of your life, you'll know what to do. You will see the signs. And it takes time. And that's one of the benefits I think of group therapy, because they can hear someone else talking that maybe at this point has become or started to realize they're in a really bad relationship. And they might be giving signs, symptoms, things that they're doing, and another person will listen to this and say, wow, you know what, I never really thought of it that way. So, you know, we had a resident too came in, and she never talked during our relationship and addictions group, which we had a start because there were so many people in addictive relationships. And she would not talk, but every once in a while you'd hear something, and you can tell it was really a dysfunctional relationship. She said up front, I'm not changing it. There's nothing I'm going to do. I'll work on this eating disorder. I'll not do drugs, and I'm not touching the relationship. She left and ended up coming back to treatment within a couple of months because the first thing she did is went back with her boyfriend, which meant she couldn't eat because she wanted to stay thin, which meant that she used drugs, which meant she lost her identity. And then she ended it back and said, you know what? The biggest relapse here was my boyfriend. So awareness is really, really important. And, you know, I think to deal with the underlying feelings and to find out, you know, you had mentioned there's a lot of trauma that's underneath this. And people equate whatever attention they're getting to being love. And if that's how they got it, one of two ways, whether it even was sexual abuse, and that's the only way they know somebody cares. For other people, it's the idea of it's just a guy. My dad never paid attention to me. So there's, you know, it's kind of looking at where is this coming from and why is it okay to be in this behavior? What is it that I'm looking for? And that's a you know, you had mentioned, you know, trying to ask some questions about, you know, your clients. You know, it's what is this relationship, what purpose is it serving? You know, what does it do for you? You know, and what does it do, not to you, but what's it doing for you? And I think that that becomes, people don't get that unless they're asked the right questions.
Well, let me ask you, because you mentioned trauma, and then you followed it very quickly with talking about sexual abuse. What are some other very common forms of trauma that men or women, particularly women, may have experienced?
Sometimes, even if it's sexual abuse as a child, and that's how they equate like a father or grandfather's love, as much as they knew something wasn't right about it, it was this, I was special. They were made to feel very special. You know, they didn't touch other people like that. They didn't take me in their car. So there's something special about sex. As much as it doesn't, it's not right, they know it's not, there's still that underlying issues, that's what makes it special. A lot of times, it's actually the physical and sexual abuse. I actually had a resident that, you know, and that's to mention the difference. She came in thinking she had a sex addiction, and what we found out, you know, she talked about a very brutal relationship, that she had been beaten, also sexually abused as a kid by her father. And it was very brutal. She would put herself on Craigslist and specifically, you know, even say on there that she wanted someone to rape her. And what she wanted was because all she knew was a reenactment of being brutally beaten and raped. Now, somebody can misdiagnose this, oh, this person just likes to be beat up and have sex, where the idea was serving her a purpose is because that's all she's known. That's all she knows she's worth. And when she's not having it, she goes and looks for it. Or we've seen, too, in sexual anorexia on the other end.
Oh, yeah. So what did you do with a woman who obviously was re-enabling the trauma she had experienced as a kid and reenacting that as an adult?
First of all, taking her back to the point that it's serving, not just that she's a piece of garbage and that's what she does, is to go back and, first of all, actually deal with the trauma. You know, the fact is if they reenact it somewhere else, especially if it's a family member and they don't want to go there with it, it's a lot easier to deal with it as trauma in the present tense or in the most recent tense. So a lot of it is getting back to what originally happened. And at some point them, because most of them, of course, think it's their fault. I mean, we know that for some reason, no matter how little, a child thinks it was their fault. But looking back that it wasn't their fault, that this isn't the way they need to be treated. They do have an identity outside of this. So a lot of it is going back to looking at that, being able to forgive themselves, being able, and again, I fully believe in working the 12 steps with this. They're powerless over their past. And at this point, they don't have to be their history. And that's really hard for people.
Oh, 100%. I would absolutely agree. And, you know, so much of love and sex addiction is trauma reenactment. I mean, we know that human beings, once they become familiar with something that has occurred in their childhood, they'll figure out a way to duplicate that as an adult until they get healthier. So at Timberline Knowles, you help people to both identify what that is and then decide what they need to do to get healthy.
Correct. That's why the groups like Empowerment that we have and Process Group and the Relationship and Addictions, a lot of those are geared towards relationships in general. And the overall treatment is the same because actually your addictions are, it's a toxic relationship to a behavior.
Uh-huh.
And so, and I've had people actually in groups write a goodbye letter, which people often have them do to their addictions. And I've had sometimes they'll write a letter, read it, and you won't know if they're writing to their eating disorder or to a relationship or a drug. And it's pretty amazing because somebody was reading a goodbye letter to a boyfriend that actually was in jail. And after she had read it, I said, you know what, why don't you replace his name with the word heroin? She did that, and she didn't have to change a word, except the very last sentence was, heroin, you turned me on to heroin, rather than his name. Then I had another one that when she talked about it, you wouldn't know it was an eating disorder. I thought she was saying goodbye to a relationship. So the idea is when they realize that, you know how we say an addiction is an addiction, the idea is this is truly something that you have formed a toxic relationship with. And that's why they go together so much. You know, the cross addiction, like I might be acting out on my eating disorder and then you get your eating disorder somewhat in remission, and next thing you know, you see they're in a toxic relationship.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So that must be what really can make you feel good about your work with these people, because not only do you help them identify that trauma, but you help them to decide what boundaries and consequences need to occur to start taking care of yourself.
Absolutely. And a lot of them don't understand, you know, it's a constant, well, why do I do this? And I think in the beginning, I always tell them, like, why is a stuck word? You know, we might not know why. It's what can we do different? But in time, they start to identify why they put up with certain things they put up with. You know, it's like, why do I do that? I can't, you know, over and over. And it's like, there is a reason. All behavior serves a purpose. Doesn't mean it's healthy. The fact is you're doing something because there is something you're getting from it. And that takes a while to realize and say, wow, I am. This is a familiar feeling. This is comfortable because it's what I know. And if they can't identify that dysfunctional relationship mm-hmm. is serving an unhealthy purpose, they can't start to work on it. Right? You got to know what a problem is before you can work with it.
Absolutely. So now tell me, if somebody's listening to the show and they're wondering, do I have a love or relationship addiction? Give us 5 or 6 criteria that would contribute towards the possibility that, yes, this is not normal, this is the extreme.
I think one of them is looking if there's an overwhelming involvement with the partner that actually starts to cut you off from life. You know, affecting whether it's your friends, your spiritual connection, the way you feel about yourself, when it's having so much it's cutting you off from who you are is a big sign.
Mm-hmm.
When there's an over-reliance on the relationship, that you go back to something despite any kind of mental, emotional, or physical problems going on with it, but you're drawn back into it. Like it's pretty blatant that this is not a healthy relationship, but somehow you keep going back to it. There's going to also be an increase craving, where I talked about that, I need this. They start thinking, mm-hmm. I need that person to live. I can't do it without them. If you're obsessing about them, you know, in the beginning, love, and you have the butterflies, but this is talking about obsessed all day long. what are they doing? You know, are they having fun without me? To a point you're not functioning, but it's a constant obsession. Again, mm-hmm. that isn't normal. I think one thing that is really hard to imagine is if they're magnetically drawn to the person. And I think this is a real big problem. People confuse intensity with intimacy. A lot of times when somebody's crazy about a relationship, most times I can ask them and I'm like, I bet the sex is great. And it's, everything else could be so dysfunctional, but because of that intense moment, what happens during that activity appears to be love and passion. So I think that's another sign is, am I confusing this? Do I truly have an emotional, intimate relationship with this person, or is my closeness just during sex? Because people put a lot of emphasis on that.
Again, they're confusing intimacy with intensity.
Mm-hmm. Does
and
that make sense?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And yet I'm thinking, for a listener who's wondering about that, they will oftentimes wonder, well, is this intense or is this normal? So if they're losing their sense of self with the other person, that's not normal. If they're putting the other person first and not paying attention to their own needs, that's not normal. If they're repeating behaviors that really aren't making them feel good about themselves, that's not normal.
Right. Things like, and you know, a lot of it is they can't stop contacting a partner. You know, we had a girl here that, you know, if she couldn't reach him, she just kept, she said she blew up his phone. She just kept texting and texting. And then after each call, she started to get like, she got crazy. She would start yelling and screaming things on the phone. And actually nothing had changed from the first phone call to like the time she had gotten to the phone. But that, it, what happens to you as a person is you become another person. You know, when you look and see that, wow, I'm totally changing based on this relationship, or again, sitting back and saying, wow, this isn't normal. I can't reach this person on the phone. I'm going to continue to call, and now I'm getting hateful and crazy, and that also leads a lot of people back to an original addiction. That could lead people back into their drinking, their drug, whatever other addiction they might be into. That uncontrollable feeling, that powerlessness over controlling that situation or that person can lead them back to their alcohol, drugs, eating disorder.
Well, that's a very good point. And oftentimes, clients will find that the very behaviors that they thought they had control of get triggered by other out-of-control behaviors. And that's what you're saying. It leads them back to extra drinking, extra drugging, perhaps eating, overeating, or anorexia, bulimia, that kind of thing.
Correct. And I think that's another thing that isn't being treated, it's not being looked at. Often when somebody comes into treatment, of course they're going to look at the primary issue. You know, someone's coming in and severely anorexic. Someone's coming in and they're a heroin addict. I mean, that's what's going to be directed. Depression. You know, they can come in purely for depression or anxiety. And, you're working on that. And, yes, that needs to be addressed. Often you look at a lot of the underlying issues. You know, somebody that's drinking because it's the only way they can have sex. And if they don't have sex with their husband, he's going to leave them. Well, yes, this person still might be an alcoholic, and there's an underlying issue that's going on here. Same thing with the eating disorder is you find, you know, when they're in a relationship, then they're fine with it. If they're out of a relationship, they stop eating because right away they think it's their weight. So a lot of the relationships have everything to do with what's going on with their addiction, whether it be a primary or an actual result of. And I, you know, the 12-step program says how you really shouldn't get in a relationship for a year. And one of those, it doesn't even mean if you're a relationship addict. It means that, you know, as an addict, you get very involved with everything else. Your mind likes to go somewhere else. And then what happens when that one person doesn't contact you or if there's a breakup? A lot of times your recovery has gone totally out the window. You're not going to meetings. You're hating yourself again. So actually just the result of even a normal relationship can drive somebody back to a primary disorder.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. And, you know, so oftentimes Patrick Carnes talks about the fact that different disorders or addictions can fuse together. And so you may start out feeling the rejection of somebody who hasn't returned your call, and being a love addict, it absolutely is devastating, and it throws you back into other behaviors that are actually fused with the relationship of not getting your needs met. And so it's so important to go to a treatment center that can treat a variety of issues. And Timberline Knowles is known as treating drug, alcohol addiction, love addiction, sex addiction, eating disorders. I mean, they really do have experts that can treat everybody, don't they?
Absolutely. And the main reason for this is, and, you know, I've been able to do this myself, sitting and listening to a group of people, it becomes the same thing. I can hear them all talk, and, you know, if they're not talking about the behavior, you really wouldn't know what they were suffering from. Because what you hear is the same underlying pain, shame, self-hate, the same time the thing of people they've hurt. And it's all this, the underlying abandonment, lack of love. So a lot of times, I think the downside is when people are in treatment and everybody else has a different issue, there's a lot of comparing. You know, well, she has this and she has this and I don't have that. And I think that's the one thing that I often bring in light in a room is right now nobody's acting out in any of those behaviors and you're all feeling the same pain and treatment's the same. You know, recovery is going to be the same, just like 12 steps. I mean, the steps are the same. And in fact, so I think the main pain is the same, just as the solution's the same.
Well, that makes total sense. Now, do you involve the partner in getting help?
Yes. And depending on, you know, and again, it depends on the partner. There's many people, obviously, that think they don't have a problem, especially if the significant other happens to be the one that actually may be abusive. There are ones that say, hey, I want to learn. I want to know. They could actually go to even an Al-Anon or Codependents Anonymous to see if they're contributing to some of this. If, in fact, one of the residents could be with a sex addict, and a lot of what they're doing, you know, and they'll think, oh, I'm a sex addict, but they're doing whatever they need to do to keep their partner. So I think it is important if the person is willing to come into it and actually lay everything on the table, because a lot of times there's a lot of other underlying issues between them, and if they can really talk about it, or a partner that's disengaging from somebody because of what they're doing. If they can understand, hey, you know, this is based on my past, but I didn't want to tell you that. And often, you know, residents are not going to be able to do that on their own. There's so much shame behind maybe what happened. When they're with a therapist, often it becomes easier to put this on the table and they feel safer bringing something up. And they're usually very surprised that it, in fact, does not damage the relationship. It will bring them closer together in most cases.
Okay, so the million-dollar question is, do you tend to treat these people together or separately?
Absolutely together. You know, this question's gone on a long time about which one do you do first, right, the depression or the substance. So many people say, do I treat the, you know, is it the eating disorder or this? I feel underlying issue is somehow you're getting your needs met in an unhealthy manner. There is some behavior, and if they're not treated together, I've seen it over and over, they will just go to one of the other ones. You know, I've had people say, well, you know, if I'm not depressed, the marriage will be great. And, you know, it's kind of looking on, you know, let's look at this relationship. And if you aren't looking at them both, and I've seen so many people say, well, you know, I just need to get my shopping addiction under control. When you find out the reason they're shopping is because they're avoiding being home with their husband because they don't want to have sex. You know, where it all goes against the woman because she's shopping, and you look at their actual relationship, okay, we better look at this together. And that's, I think, what a lot of people fall into is they want to deal with one of these and then one of these. And I've never seen that work because they're going to go to the other one. You know?
Right, and you know what we taught, and I oftentimes see this so frequently, is that you said if one isn't treated without the other, you see the other one pop up. We actually feel like oftentimes whatever disorder is not treated gets worse. So it doesn't just stay the same. It actually gets worse, and that symptom substitution that occurs intensifies the frequency of whatever is not being treated at the time.
Correct. And I think it's easier, again, to compare. It was like telling somebody that maybe was a heroin addict and thinking, well, it's okay if I smoke marijuana because I'm not doing the heroin. And the fact is you're still using a mood mind-altering drug, which keeps you from dealing with underlying issues. So the same thing is, okay, I haven't acted out in this behavior, and you find they're still acting out in this other behavior. The fact is they're not dealing with emotion because they've always got a quick fix.
100%. You're exactly right. So now, what are some of the roadblocks to getting help for a sex or love addict?
I think the main one is shame. It's looked at, especially for women. Unfortunately, we're still in a society where men, it still could be macho. Women, you're a slut. And it's still like that. You know, I know even women within treatment that it's all women. They feel very judged. So it's really hard, and you don't want to say that. If you're a mom, to come forward, someone that's a mom, the thinking people will look at you in disgust. You know, how could you be a mother and going out and having sex? The love part of it, again, it's because usually it's a very toxic or abusive relationship. They don't want to admit it because they know what's going to be asked of them is to break up with somebody. So having to deal with it, admitting it, is that's where it's going to take you. Yeah, there's a point that if I don't say it, it's not a problem. You know, but the shame too. I've seen it a lot, and that's just such. And it really takes a while. And I think for women to be with other women and realize they're not judging each other. You know, they're judging themselves, and they hear another woman's story, and they're like, I totally get why you're doing that. But you have to make it speakable, and you can't be judged. And I think that that's a really hard thing to talk about. And, you know, I've seen it with teens. You know, they don't want to say it, and it's just amazing, like, at what age they're already getting themselves into this pattern, and, you know, and they're in tears, and they have their head down, and, like, I'm so ashamed of this. You know, so shame, then, I think, is probably the main.
Yeah, I was just sitting here thinking to myself, for our listening audience that may wonder if they suffer from shame, how would you describe shame?
I would almost want to say, like, hating yourself. You know, they talk about the difference between guilt and shame, and, you know, I'm sure you've heard of this, is, you know, guilt is when you've done something wrong. And often you can actually make amends. Shame is when you feel you are wrong. And the actual shame is, I'm just a piece of garbage. And a lot of people from trauma feel that they're tainted, they're toxic, they're dirty, and they're carrying that around. They're walking around with a body that they're disgusted with. And that's the way they feel. Often they also feel that's the way they should be treated.
Mm-hmm.
I should, you know, this is the only way somebody is going to pay attention to me. And when when they look at, you know, unfortunately, another adolescent recently is just like, both guys, like, they were secret. She couldn't even talk to them in school. They said, don't talk to me. And then they'd be using her for sex. They would call her mean and awful things. And she kept saying, but I'm in love with them. And, you know, and there's such shame then behind that. It's like, why would I allow that? Why? And she didn't even want to talk about it out of fear someone's going to say, well, just don't do that anymore. You know, but shame is a constant, and that is definitely the underlying issue in every addiction. There isn't anybody that hasn't come into treatment that they outrightly will start to realize that I'm a piece of garbage. I push people away. I don't want them to get too close. And they do it by acting out in different ways.
Well, that totally makes sense. So then what is the number one way to combat shame?
Actually, a lot of it comes to, first of all, what I like about a residential area is to be around people that are accepting you just the way you are. Mm-hmm. You need to be with healthy people that see you with all your faults and still want to be with you. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have not encountered that. They're going to be judged, and when they could be somewhere and say it and someone's still like, hey, I'm right here with you, that's what's really important. Looking back at where this comes from, a lot of this shame is something that's been inflicted very, very young. And it doesn't even mean it was overtly. It could just be the way somebody was talked to, somebody that wasn't paid attention to. A lot of that feeling that means that I'm not important. That means no one cares about me. I haven't been listened to. Right in that, it goes back to I'm bad. You know, we do that whole thing, how about with little kids, you know, good girl, bad boy, rather than the behavior right away. It's about you as a person, and something you've done makes you good or bad, and that's exactly what they take on very young. I'm good or I'm bad.
And then they relive that out and create situations where they can further reinforce that until they get the help.
And further enforce that they're bad. Because bad is probably at some point where they've got the most attention. Mm-hmm. If you're striving in a family constantly to be noticed and to be loved, and you keep doing that in relationship, there's so much energy in that, and you just don't give up. And sometimes it's the only attention you're going to get is going to be the negative attention. And there's also a lot of correlation. That's what it means. When someone screams and yells and hits me, wow, that must mean they care. And they get so caught up in that and have no identity. And then deep down think, well, I must be garbage because that's the way everybody treats me.
Well, and I'm sure a lot of people listening right now, they're thinking, I want to work with Roseanne or I want to go to Timberline Knowles. They are describing me. If somebody is interested in finding out about your treatment programs, how would they go about doing that?
Well, I think, first of all, to look up the website, in TimberlineKnowles.com, and it really gives a very, very comprehensive look at everything that we treat. Mm-hmm. It has a list of the therapists. It has a lot of the, webinars, presentations, and things that have happened where you can look into that and listen to those.
Right.
You can always send questions. You absolutely can always call. If you have some questions, and ask as many questions as needed, absolutely, if somebody is questioning if they might have a problem with this, absolutely feel free to give me a call. We can go over some questioning, kind of see if it's an issue, and not feel pressured they have to fix it. Because they may not want to go to somebody else and say it, because, you know, once you've said it, people might expect you to change it, and you might not be ready to change it.
Right, right. Well, that's a good point, that you have to really be ready. So this might be the inquiry stage where you're finding out more about it and finding out what the possible treatment is for it.
And I would suggest looking up, you know, I'm not really all about those self-questionnaires, but I think if you look up online, some of the signs, usually you start looking at them and, wow, I fit that, I fit that, and I fit that. Sometimes you absolutely are oblivious that that's a problem. You just may not know. Other times, you know, they start hearing it and they're like, wow, that's me, that's me. Do you have to panic and break up with the person? No. But the thing is, I have to look at this and how is this affecting my life? What is this doing? How is this maybe adding to my other addictions, mm-hmm. my mood? You know, and it be able, because you could actually be in a healthy relationship and totally be an addict and be very dysfunctional due to it. It's not always
about
a bad.
Now, what do you mean by that? How could that be?
The fact that somebody, say it's a healthy person, you need their attention so bad that, again, that's where your obsession can come in. You can get jealous. You wait for every move, everything they say. So your life is revolved around this person. And if they're out at night, now they could be staying late at work. It's like they may feel like they have to drink. Because I don't want to be yelling at them. So it doesn't always mean the other person's dysfunctional. It is in most cases. Or the other person might be codependent. It might mean that they're loving that. So I think it's hard because everybody right away thinks, oh, no, he's great. Yeah, he might be great. And, like, what is going on with you? how much of what you're thinking, and it could be total misperceptions, and it's real to you.
Well, I think you've given our listeners some hope that there are actual treatments out there that can work through some of the trauma that maybe you've experienced as a kid or some of the repetitious behaviors that you've said a million times that you were no longer going to do and then found yourself doing over and over again. And again, Timberline Knolls is an inpatient residential treatment center. Do they offer any other specialized services in addition to residential treatment?
If you've been here for residential, we do then have a step-down program. At the moment, you need to have been in our residential, and then we go down to a continued care program, and that program is now operating separate from our own lodges. And they actually keep their same treatment team, and they're offered a lot of the same groups, but a lot more is focused on people that are now out living on their own. There is some housing here that they're in, and some are going back to their actual home environments. And that's been really helpful because they're back in relationships that they, you know, you have a couple of therapy sessions and you think, oh, the relationship's great. You know, they go home and they get to experience that and then come back in.
Okay. So there's step-down programs that actually supplement and support all the learning that you've had when you come into treatment, in inpatient treatment.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, we definitely believe in the 12-step program. And, you know, there are several. It's Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. There's Love Addicts Anonymous, Sex Addicts Anonymous. And I don't think you should get into too many of all of that. But, again, it goes back to understanding the idea of working the 12 steps in your relationships is really important. Also, the DBT, Dialectical Behavior Therapy, it works very well with the 12 steps, and it's hard to imagine, but even the idea of some mindfulness is just noting I have these thoughts, and it doesn't mean I have to act out on them. You know, noting, oh, yeah, you know, I want to make this phone call, and I don't have to. You know, distraction in the moment. People say, oh, you know, I learned to distract myself so I don't want to go to the bar and drink. Well, if it means picking up the phone and calling somebody, it's going to really eventually be detrimental. They have to believe that. Is you can go ahead and use a distraction. And in that moment, you know, just like the one day at a time, in that one moment, don't make that one phone call. So I think it's really important to use a lot of the DBT skills.
Well, that totally makes sense, too. So for our listening audience, what is DBT?
With Dialectical Behavior Therapy, the whole concept is the both and. It's not either or. And I think when you look at that, and this has been just really important for people to look at relationships, is they'll talk about one thing and say, you know, but he's great and he does this, or but, and it's like, no, and. This person can be great and they can give you all these things, and it's been abusive, it's destructive. And that's where it starts, is looking at it's both. It's together. It's a package. And I think when they realize I can love somebody and hate what they do, and you can do that together, that is a really strong foundation, is, okay, I get to look at both of these. And then another part of, you know, the dialectic behavioral therapy is it's all about noticing, yeah, I do these things. And right now I may not know how to control it, but the hope is I'm going to get control back, and that's where the mindfulness comes in, is like, oh, that's right, you know, of course I want to calm. It's just like, oh, that's right, I want to drink because that's what I suffer from, and I don't have to do that.
Well, Roseanne Rook, I cannot thank you enough for sharing all that wonderful information on love and sex addiction and the hope that you really feel is present in your mind. I hope to work with you again because obviously you do a great job of explaining this. Again, she works for Timberline Knolls, and to get a hold of them, you can go to their website, timberlineknolls.com, and look at all the programs, the services, and really get a bird's eye view of what is available out there for you. So, Roseanne, thank you so much.
Carol, thank you.
Uh-huh. And
have
we'll
a good
talk
night.
Soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So again, I cannot highlight what a fantastic treatment center this is. And, you know, they are located in the Midwest, and their mission is to make people healthy with different addictions. You're listening to Carol Jurgensen Sheets, and this is Sex Help with Carol the Coach. And as I say at the end of every show, there'll only be one of you at all times. Fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. We'll see you next week.